open this meeting of the House Committee on Health and Human Services. I trust everybody had a wonderful weekend. And I think we're going to start by opening an informational meeting on statutory framework and developing health care coverage for prioritized populations and defined benefit packages. And we have Holly Robinson here to speak to the work that's in progress. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. I believe that Sandy's handing you out two documents that I'm going to be speaking to this morning. One is House Bill 2511-1 with draft stamped all over the top of it to give you an idea that this is, in fact, in draft form. And the second is a population prioritization draft plan that I have to credit Mike Bonetto and Connie Seeley for producing. My task for this morning is to share with you one approach that may be used for the legislature's efforts to attempt to prioritize those individuals that basically have now been in the OHP standard population and who once, if you use mandatory Medicaid populations as the starting point, who and how you add back and in what order. This has not been something that's done in statute before, and there has been some interest in putting it, in fact, in statute. I'd like to begin, I think, by just basically explaining to you the population prioritization plan chart to give you a sense of how we have thought about approaching this. And again, this is I'm using other people's work products, so I use we with much gratitude to others that have produced this. What is important and what I would like to highlight for you about the chart is that the blocks that are in solid colors, no, let me start this way. The groups at the bottom are those groups that if a state accepts Medicaid money, a state must cover. And the gray shaded areas indicate those groups, initial groups that are the mandatory minimum Medicaid population that you have to cover. So, for example, starting to the left of the chart, individuals who receive old age assistance up to 75% of the federal poverty level are covered. Those individuals receiving aid to blind and disabled are covered up to 78% of the up to 78% of the federal poverty level are covered. Then you see foster children, TANF families, pregnant women, children, two groups, 0 to 5 and 6 to 18. And then finally the column to the far right of this is your adults, couples, families. Those are those individuals, working poor, others that Oregon has covered up until this point, but that are not a required population. You'll also notice sort of the spider coming down from the sky, second to the left. That's the Medically Needy Program, which is that program which at this point has provided, under the way Oregon's defined it, prescription coverage to those individuals who basically became Medicaid eligible because of a spend down due to Medicaid costs. Why this chart becomes important in sort of framing the debate is this. As you can see, there are numbers that have been superimposed on this chart, 1 to 7. That is somebody's attempt to demonstrate how, not that they would, how one might go about adding back populations. So in this particular chart, children and pregnant women up to 200% of federal poverty were added back first. Adults, couples, and families up to 25% of federal poverty were added back second, and so on. The task actually before the assembly right now is whether to start at one in terms of adding those groups back and then in what order you're going to put them. So in outlining it this way, you can then, I guess, begin to visually see who you're adding back and how you want to go about doing it. The other thing that this chart does add that I will just highlight for you is that there are some cross-hatched check boxes under the two children's silos or columns. Those are children that are covered by the CHIP program, and the reason that that's highlighted here is because the match on the CHIP program is a 72-28 match as opposed to a 60-40 federal state match. So if the state were to choose, if the legislature were to choose to add the kids back in those groups, the match would be different. Would be higher.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thanks. Holly, if we do the math, I mean, if we would say go ahead with covering children first, I mean, if we had the opportunity to do that, wouldn't that bring more, I mean, my logic says it would bring more money in, and therefore we'd have more money. We can't take that general fund money and cover another population.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ross Anderson, that's a tough question. And what this chart doesn't overlay, in part because I don't have it all yet, are the numbers piece. And that question really depends upon the number of children that you're actually serving. Is it a 10,000 or 50,000, and the cost of the cost per child to serve those. So while your match rate is higher, how much money you bring in actually depends upon the number of children in that category and how much it costs to serve them. Kids are cheap, adults are expensive. There are fewer kids also in these silos, for example, as there are in the couples in the number two box. So the match rate itself is higher, but you can't, the picture isn't going to come complete. And again, I mean, this isn't my task today. You get to do this exercise, that part of this exercise later on down the road. But the match for those children is higher. The general fund portion of that is less, but there are fewer kids and they're also cheaper. So that's all part of that big mix.
Well, and also CHIP can be expanded beyond kids, so that's also part of that mix also.
Now, what I've attempted to do, and then at some point we have to add benefits to this, but all I have attempted to do is in the draft that you've been provided, is to begin to develop a framework that says that the Legislative Assembly, if they're approving and funding health services to the Medicaid population, that they're going to serve these individuals in this order. And this list obviously starts with those individuals who are required by federal law to cover. They're not specifically listed in here. Fortunately, there's a citation to current definitions that we can use. And then the rest of the list and is just specifying who those persons are and basically at what level of federal poverty they are in order to include them. In this particular list, we've added children 5 to 19 with incomes between 100 and 200% of federal poverty first, then children 6 to 6 years and under 6, who are between 133% and up to 200% of federal poverty second, pregnant women third, et cetera. Obviously, the task for the Assembly is to reorder this list and however they choose to in their wisdom. My attempt today is to say, as you go about doing this exercise, these are the groups of individuals, these are the federal poverty levels, so you can also continue to break them down, that to begin to think about how you want to add people either now or should more money become available allows you to begin to conceptualize that. The other piece of this that I wanted to highlight for you is that you'll see on page 1 of the Dash 1 amendments, there is currently a list of 5 services that are provided that are defined as health services that are provided under the Medicaid program. And in actuality, this list, even though it looks has been amended, is the same list that this body considered in House Bill 3624 in terms of specifically defining out prescription drugs as a health service that is provided. This is the list of services that's currently provided. The other challenge that the Assembly, that this committee and the Assembly is going to face is this. If you look at, it came out neatly, page 3 of the draft, the other step that's going to need to be taken in this process is that eventually the Assembly will have to decide take each of these categories and say, if you are a Category 1, using a chart, for example, if you are a child or a pregnant woman, which of these services, A through E, are you going to get? And in the way that I've outlined this as for you to consider, individuals who are at this point in the categorically we are required by federal law to cover are going to receive all of those services. And then I only took this one step, but just to give you an example of what it would look like, persons described in subsection 2B shall receive the services in A, B, D, and E. So what that says is if you are a child over the age of 5 and under the age of 19 with an income between 100 and 200% of federal poverty, you're going to get all services except for inpatient hospital services. Now, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not advocating that. I'm just beginning to give you a sense of how you identify populations and then specify which of the specific services under Medicaid they might be provided. One of the advantages of an approach like this is that in the event that the Assembly has to make some tough decisions about which services they're going to provide, it sets up basically a matrix whereby the Assembly or the E-Board or subsequent legislatures could say, in the event of additional funding, we will either fund these additional groups of people and or we will fund these additional services. And it also sets up a paradigm where you might add some populations back, then you might add some services back, then you might add some additional populations back. But basically what this does is give you a matrix, though I hate to use that word these days, because we're not reloading this, that would allow you to at least be very clear either at the front end or as you go along what services you want to add back specifically or which population groups that you want to add back specifically. There is nothing to prevent this Assembly from being more specific about the list of health services that are listed in lines 8 to 12 of page 1 in the discussions that are taking place in the building right now in the same way that we've identified prescription drugs. That list can certainly become more specific. I don't want to say grow, but certainly become more specific to what this Assembly wants to fund. The other option, obviously, that the Assembly has is to draw, once you get above the federal minimums, draw your categories of federal poverty guidelines differently. So you might take pregnant women up to 150% of federal poverty first, then 185, and then 200, as opposed to this huge jump from 133 to 200%. But what that allows you to do, I think, is begin to conceptualize or how this process of prioritization could look like, and then how much you want to put it in statute so that as populations get added back, as benefits get added back or added, that it's very clear what's going on.
And it's part of it when we talk about lines 8 through 11, 12 on page 1. It's, for example, line 8, provider services and supplies, that includes primary care, all of DME, emergency transportation. I mean, you're just a whole list of things there, and so the question becomes for us, do we need to have more specificity in there for some populations that we might not give quite as complete a package of coverage to, so that we can delineate, so that we have decision points in statute, right? Because the way it's been now, it's just kind of been all-encompassing categories, and there may be need to have some subsets under there so that we have a menu to choose from. And I think that's one of the things we're wrestling with at the moment. So,
the other thing that I would point out for the committee is that the definition that that this draft starts modifying is the definition of health services that's specifically used for basically health services that have been provided under the health plan. It does not include other medical assistance services or health services that are provided under other portions of the medical assistance program. And I mean, there's a long-term care side. There are other parts of the medical assistance program where they also talk about health services. This definition is specific basically to the Oregon Health Plan list at this point.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Holly, just explain for me the last column, adults, couples, and families. You're proposing that that the second phase would be to go to 25%, the third to 50, the fifth to 75, and so on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, first of all, I'm not proposing anything at this chart. Okay. But, yes, in the way that this chart was put together, in part because you can add numbers into those. Eventually, there are numbers overlaid on this, but that's correct. That the second group would be added are currently those individuals who don't fit into the rest of these categories, who are at 0 to 25% of the federal poverty guideline, and then up.
This chart or this graph is what is being discussed in the Senate Health Committee currently, and I point out that while medically needy isn't a specific bar there, part of the discussion we're having with that is if there's a way to triage that population, because clearly some medically needy folks, transplant drugs and HIV and cancer drugs maybe should be at a higher level, and so they are looking currently at a way to see if we can create distinct populations inside that, with the full knowledge that for us to be able to do that would require a waiver from CMS because it is a specific Medicaid funding stream for this program, and currently we are not allowed to make those distinctions in that funding stream. But that's, you know, that's the sort of things that are being wrestled with now. Is, for example, should some of the medically needy be at a Category 2 for restoration, and the rest at a Category 4, just to throw numbers out? And if that's a potential, can we get permission to do that? Did you have another question, Representative?
Yeah, and I think you've answered a good part of it. Are these, of course, will be statutory, but can there be changes as revenues come back over the next 2, 3, 4 years? Can there be changes in rearranging these without doing it by law?
What I'm hoping we end up with is that we will have distinct populations referenced to suggested priorities, but the legislature would have the authority to reshuffle priorities if they chose. For example, the legislature could say, we aren't going to fund level one, but we're going to fund level five. Now, I doubt if that is a reality, but there will be an attempt here not to box in future legislatures to reshuffle the list if indeed they want to. What we're attempting to do is kind of lay down a framework that would allow for expansion in the future. Is that fairly accurate, Holly?
Mr. Chair, sort of.
Yes, sort of.
Chair, Representative Anderson, as this is drafted now, there is no flexibility.
I mean, there is or is not.
It's not. It would be possible to do so, but in the time that I've had to do this and to think about it and some of the discussions, and it's a question of if there's add back, we're going to go in this order.
Right.
That's how this is written now, which is not to say it can't be revised to be done differently to allow the agency to make a different set of priority decisions.
But a future legislature could change anything they want.
Correct.
So, number one, to assume the ability to do a whole lot of expansion after Sinai, I think, is more optimistic than anybody should be in this day and age. The goal of this isn't to have the revenue discussion or what should be funded. The goal of this is to lay down the framework for the decisions in the future when we're dealing with where the revenue comes. So,
And if I might, Mr. Chair, and also to put forth and be so that if the will of the assembly is to have flexibility in that process or not have flexibility to assure that that's clear in the drafting of this so that whatever policy decision this Legislative Assembly makes can, in fact, be enacted.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. Holly, in the very back of the bill under 3A and B, it notes that persons in 2A will get this and persons in 2B will get this minus, I believe, inpatient hospital. And so how are 2C on through 2M affected? What would they receive?
In however this assembly decided, I was just writing down this, highlighting what a decision it is that this assembly is going to have to make. And I got tired of typing,
so
to be honest.
This is the start of
a
list.
Right. I thought I could do this, but what's the point? This is just the start of the list and the start of the decisions that it's really to get. I think the chair's intent was to get the committee thinking about these decision points and filling in those blanks. I could have, in fact, put all the populations down and done some blanks or thrown some darts. I just got lazy. But it's to create the questions for this committee and the assembly.
We're heading into Memorial Weekend.
Absolutely.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. Another question on page 2, where this would be section 2E and 2N on the non-citizens.
Mm-hmm.
How does that clause interface with the chart that you've handed out?
Ah! Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I can always count on you to find the things I've missed. Actually, that category, that group's not on this chart.
Okay.
The Cowans are not, and I grabbed somebody else's chart, and they are on other charts that we've been working off of, but in fact, they're not on this chart.
So that would simply be another silo?
It'd be another silo, and the bottom silo, I think, is 100. I think the top of that silo was 133% of federal poverty. So the new group would be anybody above that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for keeping me on my toes. Mm.
He's very good at that.
He is.
Well,
do we have any other questions at this point in time?
Yes, Senator Anderson. Sure. Maybe verboten to ask, but I'd be interested in discussion. And I'm not sure where CMS would allow us to go, but children tend generally to be healthier than some who are older. Would it be wise to move some of the monies say to the medically needy who are really desperately in need and reduce understanding the difference in match, at least in a short term when we're down as far as we are, to move that some of the benefits more to the medically needy or to the old age assistance temporarily?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as I understand it, that is an option on the table.
How's the committee feel?
Well, what we have been thinking about, those of us who have been working on this, would be, for example, children 6 to 18, which is a separate category, and maybe those above 100%. And we do have that flexibility currently. If they're not part of the categorical population, is giving them maybe a skinnier benefit package that would not include inpatients simply because the need there is not all that great. And, the biggest thing that happens with those kids, for the most part, broken bones and stuff like that, which is outpatient or primary care at best. So, those are some of the things we're talking about, is maybe not an exclusion, but maybe a lesser benefit package sort of model. So, but these are the decisions that have to be made by folks that include a bigger group than just me. So, But it is a good point. That's why we were looking, or the Senate committee was looking at reprioritizing the medically needy from a 4 to a 2, simply based on the impact of that population and when they should be an add back, which got into the discussion of being able to see if we could create distinct, discrete populations inside there so that some could be a 2 and some could be a higher number. So, but there's a lot of questions that have to be asked before we can get there. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Can you clarify what other legislation is going to help the hospitals? You know, we on page 3, lines 3 and 4, you know, that the in... I thought that someone had said something that there was other legislation that would address the medical coverage in hospital. Is there or is there not? Do you recall?
Not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, not that I'm...
Okay.
I don't... Yeah, not that I'm familiar with in the context you're asking the question.
Thank you. Well...
And keep in mind, committee, this has draft 6 times on the front, which means that it's very draft. If there was only 3, it would be kind of draft. Okay.
Mr. Chair, does that mean I made my point?
Yeah. Oh, you very much did make your point. So, and don't get confused just because draft doesn't appear on page 2 or 3. They're also draft. So. Any other questions for Holly at this point in time? Holly, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting the issue.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting and open a work session on Health Bill 2189. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2189 was referred to us from the Committee on Audit. I apologize for not knowing the full title of that committee.
I was on it, and I can't remember.
The bill provides a method of funding for medical assistance for certain individuals receiving health insurance under the Oregon Health Plan. It declares an emergency effective on passage, and the Insurance Pool Governing Board is here to speak to the bill.
And I believe we're going to have amendments and a few other things, but we'll let Rocky speak to what this is and what needs to be added. So, good morning, Rocky. How are you doing?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm fine. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. You have before you House Bill 2189. I'll speak first to the original bill, and then I'll also give you a brief summary of some amendments that, after discussions with staff and with the chair of this committee, we are having legislative council draft. We'd hope to be done by today, but I think she is a day or so behind. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2189 provides statutory authority that allows the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which we'll call OMIP, to bill the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FIAP, for both the member's premium and the actual cost of care or services that are provided by OMIP. Under current law, FIAP can only pay for premiums and not the actual cost of care, so we're also on the FIAP side doing an adjustment to the statute that would allow FIAP to pay the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool for the full cost of care, not just for the premiums. In summary, what this bill does is maximizes the use of federal funds, expends no additional state funds, and minimizes the assessment made on Oregon insurers by matching the OMIP assessment dollars with used to pay for services for FIAP-eligible clients with federal matching funds. And I'm just going to kind of step back and try to do this in English because it gets really kind of complicated. High-risk pool. People with chronic health conditions, average premium is about $300 to $315 per enrollee, but the actual cost of services is about $430 to $440 for FIAP enrollees in the high-risk pool. So you've got about $110 to $120 that is covered by an assessment of health insurers in this state. So to the extent that we've expanded FIAP and those folks end up in the high-risk pool, it's really increased a very large burden on insurers. They've actually put in about $1.2 million through the assessment process to fund some of that FIAP expansion. What we want to be able to do is pay the full cost of services and basically match the insurer's assessment so that instead of paying $1.1 million last year, they may have only had to pay $400,000 to $500,000 because we'll match that assessment and get federal dollars. It is a complicated billing process back and forth. I think that we've provided you with a diagram to show that. But it expends no additional state dollars. It just really expands the use of those federal funds and replaces the insurer's assessment with those federal funds so that we reduce some of the burden on Oregon health insurers who stood behind both the high-risk pool and the FEOP expansion over the last 4 or 5 years despite growing assessments. That's kind of just a nutshell summary of the bill. You know, there's also some discussion about what the future of FEOP is, whether it's going to be group or individual market. And despite how or which direction we go, we currently have 1,000 enrollees in OMIP that are subsidized by FEOP. So even if we decide to move away from the individual market, and those people we transition out during that period will be able to give some relief to health insurers by being able to match those federal funds through with the assessment. The other, or match the assessment with federal funds. The other is that it would also allow, if the legislature and the governor decide at some point to expand FEOP for any population in the individual market, it would have in place the mechanism by which that expansion wouldn't be totally at the expense of the insurers. That is, we would already have the mechanism in place to get federal dollars to come into the high-risk pool. So that's kind of just a summary of that, and I can go to the amendments at this point or stop and answer questions on that.
Any questions?
Just real quick.
Yeah, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just review with me again. OMIP funding comes from money from insurance groups, and FEOP, how much? What determines how much money we get from the feds that go into the FEOP program?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, let me talk about OMIP first. When OMIP is a high-risk pool, and it's funded really with two sources, the premium dollars paid by individuals and assessment of health insurers that do business in the state of Oregon based on the number of lives they serve within the state. It's prorated. The statutes for OMIP say that we can charge no more than 125% a premium rate to those individuals enrolled based on what other commercial plans charge to other Oregonians. Now, the fact is we actually have about 110% is what the board has established. So let's say the premium for someone is $100 in the regular market. OMIP is charging right now $110. Okay, so part of the increase in services that are needed by these chronic individuals are covered just by an increase in premiums. But these folks, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, I mean, just name it, and they've got it, multiple sclerosis. Their cost of services are close to about 100, using that 100 as a base, about $185 a month. So that difference, that $75 between what they pay in premiums and what their actual cost is, we get through an assessment of health insurers, about 200 health insurers in the state, the Blue Crosses, the Kaisers, the ODS, Pacific Cares, as well as foreign carriers that do business, Aetna, Safeco. They, on a pro rata basis, number of people served, pay an assessment. Now, that assessment's very large. We're currently at about $30 to $32 million a year now that we assess for insurers throughout the year to cover the additional cost of services above the premiums for these individuals. So the intent of this bill, then, is just to help mitigate some of that assessment by replacing with federal funds. FEOP is basically determined by the legislature through the waiver, the direction they gave the governor and the state agencies through the waiver application process and the funding that they provide. And we have current funding for about 14 to 15,000 individuals, and that helps subsidize the premium payments that they incur in whether it's the individual market, the group market, or the high-risk pool. And we'll pay anywhere from 50 to 95% of the premiums not the co-pays, deductibles, and all of that, but just premium payments, depending on which market they're in. That can run from anywhere from, a group market, for example, average of $70 to $75 per month, individual market about $175 a month, and I think for OMIP that's right around $300 a month, and we subsidize a portion of that based on their income level.
Okay, let's get to the amendments.
Okay, Mr. Chair, there are four or five amendments, and I believe you have summary of those. The first is delinking the FEOP benchmark from Oregon's small employer market. And just so that, real briefly, the Oregon statute requires that we do not subsidize in the group market anything less than a benchmark that is established by the board, and that benchmark is based on the most commonly offered plans in the small group market. Well, that market is from basically 2 to 50 employees. Well, the reality is that Oregon is much more than just the small group market. It's also the large group market. It's the Safecos, the Tektronics, the Targets. It's manufacturing companies, the ag businesses over in the eastern Oregon. So what this basically does is say not the small group market, but the amendment's going to say the most commonly offered by Oregon employers, so that we really bring in more of a representation of all of Oregon employers, not just a limited number in the small group market. It still requires a benchmark that they must meet, but the benchmark is based, again, on more employers in the state rather than the limited number of small employers. The second amendment that you'll receive tomorrow removes language that splits funding between group and individual markets. Currently, we're required to have 50% of state resources towards group and 50% of state resources towards individual. Now, the legislature and the governor may direct us, and in fact, the co-leader's budget directs us, if that was to hold, to focus entirely on group coverage. Well, if you change your mind and go to individual and come back to group, every time we did that would require a statutory change. So this removes the language and basically says that we would allow the board and the agency to implement the directions of the governor and the legislature through administrative rule rather than having to come back each time for a legislative change. This would not, for example, right now change in any way what we're doing, which is trying to achieve that 50-50 split between group and individual. But again, what comes out of this legislative session, we may end up focusing more on group and beginning to phase out the individual. On the other hand, if money comes down the road and somebody wants to expand FEOP for the individual, the legislature and the governor can do that through the budget process without necessarily having to have a legislative change.
And I'd point out on this one point, we are looking at focusing on group at this point in time for this next biennium. It's better bang for the buck, number one, and that's where part of our problem with FEOP at this point in time, and where the governor and the co-chairs kind of hurt us a little bit, is trying to get employers to understand or to accept the fact that this may be something that's going to be here for a long period of time. And so when the governor defunded FEOP and when the co-chairs cut the funding, that didn't help us help us market this. But we can cover more lives for the same dollars in group, and we would like to be able to make that a focus, and so we need to remove the proportionality to allow that to happen.
Those two amendments are somewhat substantive and in terms of policy, both the benchmark and the fund splitting. The next four are minor, maybe in the big picture, but to some Oregonians, they're very important. One is a change to a definition of family. We have found that where you have children in the house who have children, the way we wrote our definition when we put this into place in 97-98 excluded the children of the children, even though they may be within that household as a part of that family. So this just allows us really for a parent who has a child, who's had a child, a 16-year-old old, to include them as part of the family to ensure that they can get health insurance. Changes to definition of health plan. We've run into some situations where there is court-ordered health care for a father who is in Texas, who's enrolled his child in an HMO, who lives in Oregon, which in essence means that person doesn't have access other than emergency services that might be covered through that HMO. This would just allow us to not necessarily count you some judgment as to when those kinds of cases occur, that they could still enroll, for example, in the mother's group plan. We could help subsidize that. And it's a very small number, but it's very sad to turn even one child away or one family away when those occur. And this just gives us a little more flexibility to meet some of those needs. The next one is a change in permanent residence language. We've been told by DHS that FEOP statutes, which didn't use federal funds when we first started, has a pretty restrictive resident language that basically says you have to reside and intend to stay here. And the federal government says you really can't require people to intend to stay here to get into the program. You can have a residency requirement, but not with I'm going to live here for the rest of my life kind of policy. So we're just removing the piece that says a resident that stays with the intent to remain here does not. Now, I will tell you that people do not come into FEOP, enroll, get health insurance, get their medical conditions, and leave the state. First of all, in the individual market, there's a waiting list that's almost 6, 7, 8 a year old. We have 10,000 people. The group market, you really have to be tied to an employer that's providing health insurance, working, and residing here. So it's we're not worried about misrepresentation of residency at all. The last one is removing fraudulent from the definitions of misrepresentation. And this really is, you almost need an attorney general, folks, here to talk about this, but there are very specific criteria in order for a behavior to be fraudulent. I think there are 7 pieces that have to be made before you can move forward through the court system to try to bring fraud charges against someone. Very often, the district attorneys, primarily because of workload, are refusing really to take these smaller cases. And because our statutes say fraudulent misrepresentation, if you can't get it proved in court that it's fraudulent, you can't go get them to repay their subsidies that they may, through misrepresentation, collected. So this kind of just allows us more flexibility to, without having to go through the court system, to recover monies paid out to individuals who clearly, through misrepresentation, were not really eligible for our program to begin with. So that's kind of a summary of those bills. Ms. Chairman, we'll be here during work session to answer any other questions you may have or any that you may have now.
Any questions? Later? Okay. Thank you. Like Rocky said, we don't have the amendments in hand. Just so you know, the chair supports the bill and the amendments, and we think this is good for the program. So. If there are no questions, thank you. We'll probably be revisiting this soon. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2189 and open work session on House Bill 2537. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2537 again comes from the House Audit Committee. It modifies the requirement for benefit levels of basic health benefit plans for small employers. You have attached, I believe, a dash 2 amendment that will be addressed later with person sponsoring the amendment. And that's it.
Okay. Jill. You've been waiting a long time for this, haven't you?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson representing NFIB. Presently, I've got about 12,000 employer members in the state. House Bill 2537 implements a basic, what I call, mandate-free benefit plan to put under the private market for small employers. as Rocky testified earlier, that's primarily 2 to 50. The impetus behind bringing this bill forward is a phenomenon in our membership, and it's statewide, where small employers are being priced out of the health insurance market. Health insurance costs have been the primary concern of my membership for the past 20 years here in Oregon. Their number one concern. And over 5 years, over the last 5 years, we've seen the average premium cost increases somewhere between 5 and 25%. That's each year. So you're talking about those premium increases built upon each other for the last 5 years. Now, how does that manifest itself in numbers of employers offering coverage? About 5 years ago, about 70%, in fact, it was 70% of my membership, there was employer-based coverage. And today that number is down to 63%. And so that's a net drop of 10% of 10% reduction. And you're literally at the point where single percentage point cost increases in health insurance are making employers consider whether they can offer that benefit or not. Now, granted, 63% is still a pretty good number relative to other states, but consider where we've come from. Obviously, we're not moving in the right direction. Census figures show that Americans who work for businesses with fewer than 25 employees were half as likely to have health insurance last year as those companies who work for companies that are much larger, with 1,000 or more employees. With regard to cost increases for our membership, just last year alone, again, I mentioned 63% of our members offered health insurance benefits, which was down from 70%. Those with no increase or increases of less than 10% amounted to 18% of my membership. So 82% of my membership, 82% had increases over 11%, 11% or more. And 37% had increases that were 20% or more. So you're seeing those types of numbers piled on top of each other year after year. You have fewer employers able to offer this benefit. And I also wanted to be clear in my testimony for the record who mandates effect. The fact of the matter is if you're self-insured or a big company in the state of Oregon, you don't have to abide by mandated coverage laws. Those laws fall squarely on small employers, who I would argue are those who have the least capability of being able to afford the costs associated with mandated coverages. So when you're talking about mandates, you're talking about the ability of small business to shoulder those costs, because small business is almost exclusively who shoulders those costs, and I would argue it's counterproductive. Speaking to the bill 2537, it's simple in terms of content. The policy obviously is weighty, but the basic benefit that 2537 offers is right there in Section 1, Sub 2, inpatient hospitalization, outpatient services, and surgery, whether it's in a hospital or ambulatory surgical center, outpatient lab and diagnostic and physician services. You'll also notice later in Section 2, Sub 13, that a small employer may offer supplemental coverages as more of a line item purchase. That ability to offer those coverages are included in this bill if an employer wants to add things on a line item basis. Now, I don't argue that this isn't this is complex policy, I understand, and there's a deep well of emotion on both sides. But from our point of view, there should be an offering on the private marketplace for small employers that allows them to access some level of coverage, because from our point of view, some coverage is better than no coverage, and private coverage is better than public coverage. And so that's really the spirit in which this bill is offered.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here also in support of House Bill 2537 and encourage your passage of it. Just wanted to point out and concur with some of JL's comments, but the private sector health insurance market is in every bit as big a crisis as the Oregon health plan is. And this legislative session, we've spent a lot of time discussing the problems with the Oregon health plan, but those problems exist in the private sector as well. Costs are escalating out of control.
I think that you've heard testimony previously from the insurance commissioner that approximately 48% of Oregonians are impacted by the insurance code. Large number of large employers have gone self-insured, and you'd have to ask them why they've done that, but I can't believe that at least in part had to do with the passage of mandates. And costs are rising because we pass mandates, all well-intended, but they do add to the cost of the insurance. We've had huge advances in medical technology that are driving the costs, and you have cost shift occurring between the Medicaid population and the private sector as well, and all of this impacts the costs we're paying. Some parts of the state, you can get family coverage in a group market for as low as about $477, and this is 2002 numbers, and that was like in Marion and Polk counties. But it is as high as nearly $1,300 in Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine County. We currently have 23 mandates, with some others being considered this legislative session, that are tacked on to every group health insurance policy that's sold in Oregon. And we're very concerned about the future of group coverage, because at some point we will have designed the perfect health plan for the private sector, and no one in the private sector will be able to afford it. So with that, that's why we're happy to be here on today with House Bill 2537 and encourage your support. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me, does this relieve some of the insurers from some of the mandates that drive up the cost of insurance? Is this a pretty basic, simple plan? And if so, in what way?
Thank you. Chair Cruz and Representative Anderson, it is billed as a basic health benefit plan. And what it basically offers, it says in the small group market, there would be a plan in the marketplace that offers what you see before you in House Bill 2537. It is an alternative that is free of mandated coverage requirements. I do it in the vein of having some affordable choice in the marketplace for a small employer, and that's why we've offered it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we aware of any amendments to this bill?
Thank you. Chair Cruz and Representative Dalto, the amendment that I've seen today is the Dash 2 amendment, which asks you to add mental health as a component.
Follow
up,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And so what are your thoughts on that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto. From our point of view, it would not make sense to have a low-cost alternative on the market and then start immediately tacking on cost to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Explain again why the comment that you said big employers don't have to abide by the mandated rule.
Thank you. Chair Cruz and Representative Mona Sanderson, as Lisa alluded to in her testimony, she's seen with her membership more and more people choosing to become self-insured. And my statement to you was big companies are predominantly self-insured, and there is a tendency to go that way, which leaves the costs of mandated coverage falling on those who actually have to purchase health insurance plans. And so that is becoming a smaller market that consists primarily of small employers.
I have a question to either one of you. Do you have any figures that show how much the mandates increase the premiums?
I think we can. I'll add my two cents on that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Chair Cruz and Representative Tomei, I'm under the impression that it's in the neighborhood of about 15%. What I've read and what I've come to accept is common knowledge.
Could you give us some more specific figures on that and data?
Sure. I'm not Chair Cruz, Representative Jones. I'm not sure how I can be more specific than saying 15%, but I'll give you what data I have to confirm that is, that's the suggest that's what I'm going from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I believe, and I have a copy of it at the office, and I'd be happy to get it for you, that the insurance division came out with a report earlier this session, and they have 15% in there.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Speaking as a small business owner myself, I'm to the point now where I'm not sure next year I'm going to be able to offer health care to my employees, quite simply because I'm in Douglas County, which is one of the fast-growing counties. And if I could offer a package like this to my employees, they'd be very happy to have that, because what they're looking for is catastrophic coverage. You know, they're looking to have a safety net in case something really bad happens, and this would give them that. So I think this is good public policy. That's my personal opinion. Thank you very much. Mark Nelson.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. As you have probably heard from me in the past, we have some concerns about the approach of this legislation. We understand the problem that you're trying to solve that has been referenced by the two previous witnesses, and I should mention that I'm also a trustee for the Oregon AOI Health Choice, so we just concluded a meeting the other day, and I am very much aware of the cost, of the rising cost of health insurance in the state. At the same time, we do not believe that the elimination of mental health and alcohol and drug from this basic benefit package is the correct way to go. And we want to emphasize that we believe mental health and alcohol and drug coverage is part of a basic health care package and should always be part of that package. We do not go into the physical health side and say we're going to cut out all cancers or all brain tumors because they happen to be very costly in a long-term type of setting. So we believe very strongly that a basic health care package needs to include alcohol and drug and mental health benefits. The Dash 2 amendments basically state that you will have coverage of benefits mandated by ORS 743-556, and that is the mental health and alcohol and drug. There have been 20 to 30 studies over the last 20 years, and every single one of them have said one thing, and that is with the infusion of mental health care into the physical health care side, you reduce cost. And it is correct on the plane across the board, a mental health benefit does increase cost. Over the long haul, however, the infusion of mental health care into the physical health side reduces cost. And that is because people are using the physical health side of the system when, in fact, they have a mental health problem or an alcohol and drug problem that is not being solved. So they continue to use the physical health side, driving up those costs because you have not addressed the mental health or alcohol and drug problem. I think it's really important that I'm not here today to ask for, there's also another mandate in statute, and that's for clinical social workers. The statute mandates that if you're going to cover the services of a psychologist or of a psychiatrist, you must cover the services of a clinical social worker. It's a mandate in statute. We're not asking for that mandate to be reinstated here. We're asking for the mandate of mental health and alcohol and drug because it is part of a basic health benefit package. And in fact, in the long run, this type of package will cost you more money without that care because you will be overusing the physical health system because you cannot access mental health coverage or alcohol and drug. So we'd like to ask you to include this amendment. We believe it's part of a basic health benefit package. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Tomei?
Thank you. You mentioned some studies that show that confirm some of the statements that you made. Can you get those studies to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, absolutely. And some of these are even Blue Cross studies and that show that with the infusion of the mental health, alcohol, and drug care, you can have, the lowest number I've seen is an 8% savings up to a highest 35% savings.
Thank you.
But it's been well documented over the years.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
But the way the bill is written, if a company wanted to have mental health they could add that themselves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, my understanding is this is going to be a basic package that is going to be put together. I don't see the provision where it can be added, but it may be well that they can. But my understanding is that the director shall approve the basic health benefit plans after a determination that the plans provide the following. And does that mean the director is foreclosed? No, but I think it's clearly the intent, as you heard in the testimony, not to provide this kind of coverage. I should also mention that pregnancy is a mandated benefit in the statute. As I read this, pregnancy would not be covered. I may be wrong in that determination, but again, it's limiting, and I understand where people are trying to go. I'm just saying there are certain things that should be part of a basic health benefit package, and we just disagree that mental health and alcohol and drug is one of those things. I don't believe clinical social workers are part of it. I think the system would use clinical social workers. We provide 55% of the outpatient mental health care, but I'm not here arguing that, or for optometrists or psychologists. They're also mandated in statute. But only for what I believe is part of a basic health benefit package.
Page 3, section 13 allows for supplemental coverage, so okay. It is in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mark. Michael.
Morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michael Mortar. I'm an analyst with the Division of Insurance, which is housed in the Department of Business and Consumer Services. I wanted to just express the agency's reservations with the bill. While we certainly recognize as regulators the issues that are in the market right now, the problem that the 2537 would create for us is that this statute provides a framework by which HIRAC evaluates the basic benefit plan. And in talking with some of our folks at the agency, two parts of the statute that would be removed in this, and recognizing there are some dash twos before you, but just speaking to the original bill itself, there are two removals of language. Section 1, sub 2, subsection A, where we talk about the social values portion, as well the basic benefit plan further down dealing with the mental health and alcohol pieces. We had some concerns that what does this mean if you pull this out? What is then the directive to HIRAC in evaluating this? And those were our primary concerns with this.
Could you explain that a little? I mean, how does that change the universe from your perspective by removing that language?
Well, understanding that, again, I can't speak on behalf of HIRAC, but as those that would certainly provide issue to them, I guess that's the framework from which they view it. Now, if we're pulling that out, clearly we're changing that framework to, as the legislation directs here, it is a much narrower world at that point, is what the legislative directive would be through this bill. And we simply don't know what that world looks like. I mean, clearly you've specified that, but we do have some concerns there. To skip back just a little bit, Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei would be happy to get you some information too. You'd asked on the mandates question, and we do have some information that I can get to the committee.
Great. Thank you.
We'll do that.
Okay. Well, I'm still kind of stuck here, Michael. I guess, we're clearly setting a different benchmark, and we're clearly separating it from a Medicaid benchmark, and that's a policy decision.
Correct. Okay. It is.
I've made my point.
May I ask the question?
Yes. Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Michael, the previous speaker suggested that pregnancy would not be covered. How do you read this?
I'm assuming, through the chair, Representative Tomei, that was my reading on the bill as well, but that it would fall back to the section that Chair Cruz spoke to, that would be an add-on under section...
It would have to be an add-on?
Correct.
Yes.
That's...
Wouldn't it?
That's... Well, that's my cursory look at that, Representative May, but can certainly circle back to you as well on that, and I'd be happy to have our technical folks look at it. But that was my understanding.
But I guess my comment to that would be, and I'm going to totally personalize this to the people that work for me, you know, in my produce stand. These 40 and 50 year old and 60 year old women and men are probably not going to be having any kids anytime soon, and so it's not a benefit they would need. But I would assume that if I had a younger employee that wanted to have an additional benefit, that could be provided. Is that how you read this? But that would be an optional benefit that could be purchased.
Through the chair, that is how I would read this, but I'm also more than happy to circle back with the folks in our shop and double check that, but that's my understanding.
Thank you.
And so one could also assume that if a business had a fairly young set of employees and that was a benefit that they wanted, they could certainly have it. So, but
Mr. Chair, we have many unplanned pregnancies, especially since we don't provide any kind of prescription coverage for contraceptives. So I think even though people might not be young and theoretically planning a family, these accidents do happen.
Accidents happen all the time, Representative, and if we think we can provide for every contingency, we're going to be here a long time. Any other questions of Michael? Thank you very much. Maybe I'll stand at ease for a moment. You guys want one more time on this?
Oh, yeah.
On this bill, we're gonna give members of the committee a little time to digest and maybe give Michael a chance to kind of circle back on some of the questions, and then we'll revisit the issues. I'm going to close the work session on 2537, and we are adjourned.